cut out when I said skit.
Okay. Oh my God. We got to cut that. Strike that from the record. Malpractice. Hi.
Hi.
This is Rant and Review, where we rant about current events and then review a culturally relevant topic and give it a completely arbitrary rating. I'm Katie.
And I'm Allison.
And this week we will be reviewing
housing. Hi, Katie.
Hi.
How are you?
Good. How are you?
I'm good. I'm really excited for this episode.
Yes, I know. It's one of your...
This is my one of my
favorite
hot topics. Kind of on my mind a lot.
Always, I would say.
Which some aspect of it. It's an important topic.
Yes.
And we have a really amazing guest. Our guest is a tech worker and is an advocate for housing as a member of Tech for Housing, which is amazing.
Mm-hmm. It's very interesting.
An interesting angle. Mm-hmm. So we'll get into that. And then he also advocates with the Seattle King County Coalition of Homelessness and on the Seattle Renters Commission. Please welcome Calvin Jones.
Thanks so much for having me.
We're so excited to have you.
Yeah, this really is like Allison's favorite topic to just in life to talk about, to rant about. So it's perfect.
It's so rantable.
It's incredibly rantable.
Yeah.
Like that. Really important, arguably a human right, and like not being met a lot of the time. So
yeah.
Pretty.
Yeah. And in our city, it's like.
Especially an issue.
You know, an issue.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm excited to get into it. How has your week been?
It's been pretty good.
Yeah.
I've been. Doing some advocacy this week. On Monday, we had a public hearing for some environmental regulation laws that are actually mostly hijacked to prevent housing policy reform. So the city was looking at what's called the SEPA. And did
I heard this described as very wonky, but important.
Yeah, it's basically like anything the city tries to do that's related to housing, like build affordable housing at Fort Lawton. Homeowner groups will like use SEPA to sue the city and then delay that housing policy for years on end. So when we think about the Seattle process, SEPA is like a really important part of that and kind of needs some reform.
Name checking the Seattle process. Grumble, grumble.
The Seattle process.
Grumble, grumble, grumble. Can you describe the Seattle process to people if they're not aware of what that is?
It's basically the idea that everything in Seattle needs to be talked about for years and just relitigated over and over. And that if we want to do the tiniest little thing, it takes forever to get done. Yeah. And so nothing kind of gets
done. It's like the system of like weird, endless discussion and like panels and groups and like presentations and more discussion and more open. Like it's like endless.
Yeah.
Every project is endless.
And I think we have this idea that like, oh, the more we like kind of like hash things out, the better things will become. But like, when we take time to take these issues, like these have costs, like housing gets more expensive every day, like the climate warms every day. And so when we spend time litigating these issues, we're losing opportunities to make things better.
Yeah. It sounds kind of like a too many cooks situation, you know, where everybody's just chiming in.
Yeah. There's been some real like dicey situations that have happened recently. Well, let's get into
that. Let's save that.
Let's get into that when we get more into the review. Yeah. What do we want to rant about this week?
You're the only one that has.
Yeah, I had a very specific note. Should we talk about the debates first?
Okay. Honestly, what is there to say about these debates?
Yeah, should we just. Yeah, I know. It's almost like.
Like, who even cares? Nothing happened. Everybody said the same shit they always say. And if anything, maybe like noodled more than it. I mean, there were some specific failings, I think. Mm. Or like, for instance,
like
Kamala
more misses than wins.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Kamala Harris didn't like say anything.
Yeah, Kamala Harris came off as like kind of weird and maybe
super
awkward.
Weird. Yeah. I was like, what's up with her? She's like talking super slow and looking wistfully over there. It was like, what are you doing?
Kind of awkward laugh at her own joke that wasn't maybe that funny.
Yeah, like, there was a lot of jokes.
Yeah, you loved all the failed jokes.
It's like, if you're gonna make a bad dad joke, it has to be at least like vaguely funny. I mean, I'm the first to say I love a good pun.
Is this just like it's just an issue that it's going on for it's such a long time frame. There's still too many candidates and there's still too many opportunities for them to kind of
fuck up
or just be like overmanaged or like over
always, like overcorrecting like, always
okay
that happens, so like, I gotta go over here and
all right, like we don't need nuance on your ability to make a joke. Like, yeah. that's not yeah. a, like, needed thing.
But, like, maybe riffing on that idea, like, maybe, like, fuck-ups are important, and that, like, if you fuck up, yeah. like, Trump will, like, really, like, say a bunch of dumb
well,
shit.
Well, absolutely,
like,
in the case of Biden, I would oh, say.
Yeah.
Biden, Biden's a problem.
He continues to be
we
a problem.
We have a lot on the books right now.
Oh, my God. Yeah, he, I know. He's got, like, a fucking Bible's worth of gaffes. I mean, it's like the list just keeps getting longer by the second. It's embarrassing.
Yeah.
But a friend anyway. Texted me that he Biden's sentence completion rate was like 40% last night. Okay. He just was constantly interrupting himself.
This is what I keep saying, and I'm very shocked at how people
interrupting him.
People won't accept that when I say that. I'm
really?
Like, I've watched every single debate.
I think it's getting more obvious.
Every single time he does not complete a sentence.
I think Katie was an early. She was.
I was an early adopter.
Early adopter of the Biden of is losing philosophy. His marbles. Of losing his marbles.
Okay, right, but
that
I was.
Stock gone way up.
I've been saying that, and everybody's like, "Well, I don't. Is that fair?"
I was that way too. I was like, "Okay, like, yeah." I think it's because, like, I'm a little bit because, like, you know, Bernie is older and Elizabeth Warren
yeah,
is
but
older.
He completes
so
sentences.
I don't want it to be like, oh, you know, if you're. I've seen people say like. I don't want to elect a president that's that old. And I just don't think that's the rule. But with him, it's like, okay, yes, there are some serious issues. And someone was like, it's worse than Trump last night. Which I was like, whoa, that is.
It's an interesting comparison.
That's whoa. A hot take. Yeah, we'll put it that way.
It is a pretty hot take. Yeah.
It's not good. It's not like better than Trump. But how about that? It's not necessarily better than Trump.
I do feel like it is the kind of thing that Trump would be able to just like make
eviscerate.
Endless sleepy jokes and eviscerate him on the campaign trail. And like, but actually, I kind of feel okay about it because I feel like his like polling lead is like mostly just name recognition and like he's just going to gradually lose it over time and then someone else is going to be like, I'm not like, I don't think he actually has a path to nomination even though he's in first place.
But
right
it's
now.
Still so high.
But and the thing is, everybody keeps being like, but he, like there's this sort of strange collective. Already acceptance that we're just gonna have to go with him. That's what I'm hearing on like all these podcasts
oh,
and stuff.
God,
and I'm like,
not.
Why are we saying this? Like, I don't think this is the only way.
Well, the really bizarre thing was the media reaction right after. I don't know. Did you see any of the like post coverage?
I saw
like,
some of them.
The big media takes were like really,
really
weird. They were like, Biden had a great night. Like he,
well,
you know, he had some like really great moments and the Castro attacks were way too far.
Yeah,
and
they were petty.
Called him mean and
they
rude
said that
and
people are
stuff.
Thinking
like,
are feeling like Castro is being petty. And I was like, what?
Well, ABC literally covered it like a sports event. It was like annoying as hell. And I was like, I cannot. Take this, so I turned it off right away.
I wonder if people in the media are allowed to just say like Biden sounds old, like because you can't really. It's like hard to back that up with like the specific quote or something like that.
Well,
but, like,
no, it's not when
that
he's like
rambling.
Oh,
no,
I guess when he's
text,
rambling.
That text of like that one answer where it was just rambly and like changing topic like seven times
that's,
and brought
that
up the
is
record
like
player.
Trump. That is like
that
the record player.
The record
player.
When he's talking about like he's what was the beginning of it? He was talking
about. The question was
racism. Racism.
How do we? Deal how do we how do we move on and accept and recognize the legacy of slavery in this country right
like,
and he was like
question.
You have
and
to,
he ended it with
you have
play
to leave
a record
the, you have to leave the record player on so kids are hearing words. It's like, what the fuck are you talking about, dude?
I think that's like a kind of like racist thing to say, like it's
absolutely.
He's basically saying that like you know, like, like black families don't know, like, how to parent correctly.
No,
they don't spend as much time at home with their kids.
It's right.
Like,
and they're not exposing them to language and all of this. It was like, what
I
the
I literally
fuck?
Saw someone, like, unpack it. Like, they had to interpret what he was saying during that whole long spiel and was like, in this little fragment of a sentence, he was saying this. And in this little fragment of a sentence, he was referencing this. But he can't, like, form cohesive thoughts about all
and
this
those,
stuff.
And those little fragments are like really bad, like not based on that. Like maybe maybe like, you know, black families like speak, you know, have fewer words spoken to their kids because they are like forced to
because
like,
of systemic racism,
yeah, systemic racism and like economic inequality and all that stuff, and, like,
which have
like,
affected the level of education. And it's like literally goes back to slavery yet again, which is the question that you're evading.
Right.
Like the point is, he didn't answer the question. And instead, he went on some weird old guy rant Right? I mean, that to me was like the perfect example of the fact that he's too old. And I don't mean in age, literally, like the number. I mean his psychology.
Right. Yeah. I think that's a fair way to put it. It's like, it's like if you're like 80 and like really sharp, then I was like, it's fine. Yeah. But like, I don't think Biden is that.
I think there are some serious fears. And I just, it just worries me that the media is still like not even. They're not, they don't even say I also anything
think,
about it.
Okay, here's what I think is happening. The bar is kind of low for him to have like a good night. Like as long as he doesn't fuck up that bad, it's like, hey, that was a pretty good night.
He didn't lose that much ground. Like, right? Yeah, that's good night.
Versus everybody else is like fucking climbing their way to his weird pedestal. And it's like, I don't understand.
Which is not that much of a pedestal, really.
Well, not anymore.
He's like almost in some polls, he's like tied with Warren and Sanders.
Yeah, but so. If I'm like, if I'm on stage and I'm looking around and like Biden's in first place and also looks like the weirdest candidate, like totally my strategy is to go after him and try and like take a pop, you know, crack at him and, you know, get some points back.
Yeah, which is why I'm not sure why anyone's take was, oh, Castro looked petty and mean. Like, all he did was point out the obvious, which is he won't fucking answer a question, and he leans on his relationship with Obama. As
and
some
also
kind
that,
of-
to me, feels a little racist just because... So, like, that was happening all the time when it was the big crowd of candidates, and, like, all, like, random, like, young white guys would do that same thing. Yeah. So, I don't... I'm just like, whatever.
Right. And, like imagining if, like, Trump said something like that. Like, I think the media has such a hard time covering Trump because he just says absolutely crazy and evil shit all the time.
Right,
and then, like, you know, to, like, go after Castro, I was like, oh, you know, he, like, wasn't maybe correct on whether or not people have to pay premiums or something super specific.
Right.
Like, Trump is out there, like, you know, dismantling the EPA and, like, calling... people like, you know,
well,
and
like redrawing maps so that his theory about hurricanes are, you know what I mean?
Right.
I mean, it's like just
well, the craziest shit was his all this like military base in Scotland shit that's happening right now.
Yeah.
I don't think we have the mental capacity to get into to like get how into wild that is. Yeah. Like, that's insane. What did we think about Yang's like giveaway? His like
t-shirt cannon, like, basically.
What is he like giving away, like $1,000 to like
he
a
was
bunch
like
of
the
random
10
families.
The first 10 families who sign up on my blah 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 platform. Yeah. It basically is just a way to get people's information.
Yeah, it's like, I don't know, I feel like Yang is like smells a little bit too much like tech saviorism, and I'm like not a big fan
of that
idea.
Yeah, how do you feel about that, Calvin?
Like, I think like in the work I do, like I'm a tech worker and like also do a lot of housing advocacy, and I think it's like really important to avoid tech saviorism that like there is no app that's going to solve homelessness. There's no
right,
you know, like saving the environment like involves like foundationally restructuring our society and not just like some like innovation that makes the rest of it go away.
I feel like
tech has like so little respect for existing institutions that do a lot of amazing work and are like in a lot of ways the bedrock of our society, and that tech saviorism is just kind of this gross way of saying like, oh, we can just like forget about all that and like move on to the next thing, give everyone $1,000 and like that's all our social problems
are gone. As if that I just don't see that as like some kind of saving grace that's gonna like fix everything.
And is he gonna,
that's his only thing,
is he also going to fund Social Security, is he also going to fund health care and Medicaid, and is he also going to continue like food stamp program, like like that's the kind of shit that I'm like probably not, like he probably doesn't give a shit about all the rest of the things that make the most sense to people, like that have worked for decades and decades for, you know, for all these things. He's just like, whatever, like I'll give you cash. I don't know
it's like it's very like sale, buy now, like it, you know, it's
well,
like
that,
a flash.
Someone was like, someone was like, he just looks like he's like on an episode of Shark Tank every
and he's so stiff. I cannot get over the stiffness, and like the fact that he can't button his top button because his neck is so like it's so tense.
So Silicon Valley hip.
Do we have like anything really important to say about the debates? As a closer here.
Actually, they were kind of a snoozer.
Such a snooze.
Yeah. I'll be real. Like, I love Elizabeth Warren. I was, like, hoping for, like, a like great shiny moment for her. She said that was fine. Like,
yeah, it was just more of, like, she's just consistent.
I think it was a win because she was consistent and good and didn't... I mean, and no one went after her, which is hilarious.
Yeah.
Because she actually probably... I think she had the best outcome.
But I wonder... I kind of feel like... I don't know. Like, what is someone going to go after her for?
I feel like just the like, healthcare, like this plan is expensive. How are you going to pay for it? Yeah. And she did dodge a little bit of the question about like, you know, our middle class tax is going to go up on healthcare.
Right, right, right.
And it's like, maybe that, but also I feel like, I don't know. I feel like Medicare for All should be way more saleable than it is right now. I feel like Bernie and Warren are like still like a little bit struggling to quite hammer the message.
I totally agree. Right. I actually got in an argument on Twitter with someone this week.
Best place to argue.
They were like, well, an average American will not like this argument. And I was like, well, yes, I will concede a little bit that they haven't quite framed it exactly right, which we've talked about actually, like they haven't actually like crystallized it in exactly the right way, but I also don't like so-called progressives like mischaracterizing things to make that argument, and I'm like, why would you like latch onto that and use that talking point, because it just doesn't, it's not helpful. I feel like they just need a little time to like figure, you know, obviously the comms people are probably like trying to figure that out currently, like
and I think crystallize is such a good word, because I feel like if you're running in a general election against Trump, like the discussion is not about like middle class tax rates, like the discussion is going to be way more like principles, high level, and so like crystallizing it and just making it be about like healthcare is a human right, and like that's kind of the talking point, rather than like, oh, here's how much deductible and here's how much copay. Pay
and you will you will end up saving money in the long run,
which is what she keeps saying, and I don't know that I classify that as dodging the question. I think it's just like, nobody, there's no way that she can say you will save $3,000 on the dot. You know what I mean? Yeah. It's just like there's no point in getting in the weeds about it, because we don't even know where the weeds are.
And the other issue, I think, that the biggest, one of the biggest problems with it is that I think people can't even conceptualize this other system.
Right.
Like they're so enmeshed in this like fucked up, horrible like situation that they're like, wait, what are you telling me? Like they're not, like you brought up the Overton window. It's like they mentally haven't even like gotten to a place where they're like, oh, like I wouldn't have a monthly like they're just like, you know.
Well, yeah, they don't get that like they just aren't paying out of their paycheck every month for this thing. It's like part of the larger taxation system.
Right. I think in general, like I see this in a lot of local politics too. Like people are afraid of change. Like the status quo is like very easy to imagine because it's all around us. Yeah. And then there's this other thing over there and it looks different. And oh, I have my insurance and that's what I used to go to the doctor. And so I think change is scary for a lot
And you don't have empathy unless you, like I just always think it's like a privileged thing too, because like, oh yeah, of course you wouldn't understand the scenario where this is an issue for you if you've never experienced that issue or anything close to it. Yeah. So you wouldn't imagine the scenario where you don't have, you actually, you've been employed, but you don't have insurance for 60 days, or you, you know, had to pay out of pocket even though you have insurance because you have some illness or whatever. You know what I mean?
Like, I just don't think it should be that hard to like
it's
imagine.
Hard for people to have empathy.
But that's what I mean.
Or to, you know, imagine these other scenarios that they haven't experienced.
And that's why I feel like the crystallization and the principles are so important, because it's like let's, if you just talk about deductibles and like the deeper into the weeds of it, you know, it's just like kind of like weird and scary, you know, entirely.
Well, and
I think it's like principles, like, you know,
that's where people get lost, because they're like,
well, and I don't think they're ever going to
get too much info.
There are definitely people that aren't going to be convinced that a government program
is going to be better,
will be or better managed. There's just people that like still don't trust government institutions.
I think that is a like super interesting idea and like really foundational to, I think, a lot of the debates we have. Like, If we go back to like the Affordable Care Act kind of like legislation, and like there's two parts of the Affordable Care Act. There's the like exchanges, which are like part private, part public, and like super Rube Goldberg contraption kind of like complexity. And then there's just like the Medicaid expansion, which is just like brute force, good old government program.
Yeah.
And like the brute force government program was the one that saved it. That was like West Virginia could not have Medicaid. That's the thing that
fundamentally
worked.
People love the shit out of that part, like they're like, I love my Social Security, I love my Medicaid, like they're like, don't take my shit away from me, but only after it's been given to them,
I feel like I wish Democrats were less afraid of being pro big government. Like I feel like government is the institution that will solve the largest social problems in our time, and we need to start government programs like Social Security, Medicare for All. Like these are like large expansions in what the government does in our lives, and I feel like we got to own it, and that's a good thing.
Because I mean, that is our thing, right?
Yeah.
As like the Democratic Party, the thing is that the goal of government programs and government in general and taxation is to help everyone.
Yeah.
Like it's like a system that we all pay into and we all get paid out of, basically.
Yeah.
Yeah.
In services. Okay. Let's move on to this SNL thing.
So do you watch SNL?
I don't. I'm sorry.
Oh my God.
I know. I'm a bad person.
No.
Well, not a bad person.
That's just like intriguing.
No. Well, anyways, this is like...
It's actually like not so much... About that. Having watched SNL.
Yeah, yeah, really the only background you need is that, you know, they have a new cast announcement every year where they like usually some people, like maybe people leave and then there's like new castmates that are announced or whatever. So this week is when they make the announcement and there are three new cast members. One of them is named Bowen Yang and he was a writer last season and he played Kim Jong-un in a skit and he's Asian American. He's like very cool.
He's super funny. We love him.
He's just super funny. He's like the best, like amazing, you know, I don't know. The list is like forever. He does these like really impressive, what are they called? Yeah. Dub smash where you like lip sync to a clip or whatever.
Oh, nice.
Anyways, so he's on the cast as a full cast member, which is exciting. Then there's this other guy who got cast, who is like this guy from Philly and just this like white guy. So the announcement all happens at the same time. And then everyone's like, Bowen Yang. And like on my timeline, I don't know if it's custom to me, but like it was like trending. Like everyone was like, congrats.
Well, because he's the first Asian cast member
yeah
ever. Oh, right.
Cool. Yeah, and like so. First open queer cast member in a like a really long time. That's like surprising. I think there was one but like a long time ago. Oh. so like a real like groundbreaking moment or whatever. Then like literally one minutes or 2 hours later this clip comes out of the white guy that got cast and he is recording a podcast. It's a video of him recording a podcast with this other guy. And he's literally just like...
It's like nonstop.
He's like just being racist. Ooh. Like
talking about Chinatown and, and like using the C word slur for Chinese people. Like openly.
Like casually
stuff.
Just like dropping it. And like...
And it was literally like one after the... Like every single thing he was saying
was like was like heinous. Like it wasn't even like that's lightly so gross. Where you're like... Like you know when your ears perk and you're like, oh, that's weird.
Well,
it wasn't even that.
It wasn't like a microaggression. Let's put it that way. It was
constant,
an aggression.
Like real bad, like intense racism. Like their like comedy was basically like making fun of Chinese food, making fun of Chinatown as like a thing and the buildings and like architecture.
Well, also just so dumb. I have such a problem with like people trying to defend super shitty comedy in quotes that's just full of racist, transphobic, homophobic shit and being like, but it's comedy. It's like, well, it's not funny.
You have to push the boundaries. But it's not funny. Yeah, like the whole point of comedy is to be funny. So if it's not funny to a huge amount, like most people.
Yeah.
If you're like pushing the boundary in an interesting direction that is like maybe good for people and they like need to explore that area more, they're like, that's cool. And like, I think that's actually like a really cool use of comedy.
Yeah.
But like to just push it in the racist direction.
Well,
just,
and
like,
there's like obviously punching up and punching down. Like if you're like a white person, you're punching down when you're like talking about marginalized people, whatever. There's like another part of the clip that was like him calling other comedians who are like,
oh right,
kind of like softer, like
right. So it's homophobic too.
He was calling them gay slurs. Yeah, yeah, it was just like, ugh. And so, anyways, I
forgot about that.
It's really
part.
Upsetting because I just love Bowen so much, and like the thing that's like heartbreaking to me is that his like moment is just
overshadowed.
Like, oh, I just
well,
hate
and now
it.
He has to, that's his coworker too.
That is another really good point. Yeah, that someone else
that he's
up.
Now that he's like, not only is this huge internet fucking, you know, thing happening
right
regarding specifically like being racist against Asian people too,
specifically while, Chinese people
right, while
Bowen is Chinese, by the way, Chinese American,
while he's like being announced as the first Asian cast member. It's just like too much.
It's almost
so what's SNL doing here? Like what's the response?
That's
so far?
What I know. That's a great question. And they have not responded to anything. Well, like everyone's been asking them for comment. They haven't said anything.
That seems bizarre.
And
to not
and
say
to
anything.
Me, that's the bigger fuck up. Like I'm like, yeah, obviously this guy is an idiot, like racist asshole, whatever. And also, he releases not apology where his apology goes.
Apologies.
It's like, you know, the notes app, like when people do an apology in their notes app and then like, screenshot it.
Yeah.
It's like so bad, but it was like oh, I'm happy to apologize for anyone who actually got offended. And, I just like really push the boundaries and like most of my comedy is edgy.
I'm edgy is so gross. It's like, oh, it's who I am. Like, yeah. It's in my nature to just be a huge racist. Right. It's
like, sorry, yeah. I'm just a serial killer. It's just who I am. Right. Like, what do you want from me?
Oh, but what is it? So like, why did SNL not vet this person properly?
Well, who's doing background checks?
Clearly, it's like easily Googleable. Because like immediately people were like, what about this?
So the other thing that happened is that someone, a reporter at Vulture, actually did research and went to Philly and or called people or whatever in the comedy scene there. And they were like, oh, yeah, like we don't let him perform clubs. Like they don't allow him there because guess what? He's used slurs and like attacked like women and minorities and stuff. And so they're like, yeah, we don't like allow him to perform. And then someone else was like, yeah, it was just like really disturbing for our community in the city that they would like cast this person. So it's not like, also like, I'm sure they didn't have to do that much digging.
Right. I mean, you basically just have to ask someone who knows them. It's like, hey, is this guy an asshole? And like,
right. Like they, I guess they didn't call his references, you know?
Ray Sani, she was like, yeah, like think about if you're like, I mean, obviously it's SNL, so that's not a thing, but like, or maybe there is, but they have no power, but like HR wise.
Right.
Oh, you have to work next to this person who's like using slurs within the last few years. You know what I mean? It's like a liability. Like,
yeah. Worse. That's the worst part about this is not only like he now has that weight thinking about this upcoming season and thinking about working with this person. And then he actually has to do it. It's like, you know what I mean? Yeah. Just the like emotional weight of this at being also the only Asian person like in the room at the same time
while trying to be funny.
Right. Like, I would have exactly.
I
can only hope that writers like Julio Torres et al. Are going to like troll this guy from the call's going to come from inside the house kind of situation. And they're going to like write parts for him where he has to like be gay or be something.
Yeah, you know what I mean? Just like troll this asshole.
He's like in drag every episode.
Yeah. Yeah. So, shall we get into our main topic?
Yes, please. Okay, so let's get started by talking about how you got into housing as like a topic, like a little bit more about your background and like why you got interested in it.
Sure. So I moved to Seattle in 2014 for a job with Microsoft, and I think I spent the first 2 years of my time in Seattle just figuring out how to be an adult and pay taxes and just bring structure to my life. But I got to the point where I like noticed that there were a lot of like problems around me and like homelessness is a very jarring issue. And I wanted to like do something and help out.
Yeah.
So I started like looking for some volunteering opportunities and did some of that and did that for about like 9-ish months. But, you know, showing up to a homeless shelter and playing Legos with kids is like fun. And you like to think that you brighten their day. But it also feels like you just did, you know, you added a drop in the bucket and really didn't move the needle, and the fact that the kid like doesn't have a place to sleep at night,
right?
To call home. And so I think I started like researching these issues more, and it's like pretty quickly fell down the government policy rabbit hole where it's like a lot of the real more substantial solutions to these problems rely on government policy. So I ended up doing some research. I joined a group. I joined the Seattle Renters Commission, which is a group of, there are 15 of us, and we're supposed to represent the interests of renters to the city council and the mayor's office, which was really fun and kind of like was the first step into housing policy. And through the Renters Commission, I met a guy named Ethan Phelps Goodman, who founded Tech for Housing. And we talked, and I think we kind of shared a lot of philosophical views about housing and housing policy and sort of what obligations tech workers have to the rest of society and things like that. So joined Tech for Housing and have just been doing it ever since. I think that housing issues and housing policy, both locally at the state level and nationally, are some of the most impactful issues that, you know, we work on as a society. And I really do think that with the stroke of a pen, we could solve these issues within the next couple of years. And really, it's just about building the political will and the coalition and the kind of advocacy around those issues. And so I think it's been really important for me. Really fulfilling and also really fun. I met a lot of great people through this.
Yeah. So how long has Tech for Housing been around?
Sorry. I think I've been involved with it for like 2 years, and then Ethan had it going for like a year before that as well.
So it's pretty new.
Pretty new,
it's Seattle.
Yes, Seattle-based. Like, we were originally called Seattle Tech for Housing, but Ethan changed the name to Tech for Housing because there were a lot of state-level issues that he wanted to kind of work on. Mm-hmm. And if you say you're from Seattle, it's very easy for people at the state level are kind of like, oh, the Seattle people are just crazy and like kind of dismiss you. So coming up from more of a like just general banner and not a Seattle banner was helpful for that. And we also have some members on the east side, so we're not entirely Seattle-based.
So how many members in Tech for Housing?
It depends on how you kind of draw the line. There's like 800 people on the email list and 500 people on the Facebook group and like probably like 30 people that sort of will show up to an event over the course of like a 4 month period. And then probably like 6 to 8 of us who are like really passionate and do a lot of this stuff and like show up to every meeting and do all the volunteering events and stuff like that too.
So I mean, 800 on the email list is pretty good.
It's pretty good.
That's not bad.
Yeah. I mean, I think it goes to show like how, what a cool like niche it's in. Like it's like, it really could speak to someone who's like into housing as a topic, but then also like, I think what you were saying about like working in tech is really interesting. Like, particularly after 2016, after the election, I was like, oh wow, I like really need to become more of an, like my activist like button got triggered again. Like, and I was like, okay, I need to like get involved. Like, what are the topics I can get involved in? And everyone's like, go local, you know? Yeah. And so like, I think that like, and I think that was like hit for a lot of people where they were like, oh, I like really need to like find stuff to get involved in. And so I think this group is like a really cool blend of people who like, you know, usually have a little bit of privilege, a little bit of money, a little bit of spare time. Like, even if they're very busy or whatever, they can like do something and they might care a lot about this specific topic. So it's really cool.
Yeah. I think a lot of people, like, I think that people want to sort of do good things for other people and that they're generally good and that like tech workers, like you said, have a lot of privilege and like, there's not a lot of like great, like super organized outlets to kind of work on these issues. Like, even volunteering can be like hard and tedious and there are like different groups you can show up and the volunteering events aren't always fun. So I do think that I like my dream for Tech for Housing is that is a super easy way for people who want to make a difference on these issues. It's, you can engage or however much you like, maybe just volunteer, maybe be a super advocate. But I think that we have enough like energy for people who want to do good in the city and we just need to kind of make it easy for people to channel that energy.
Yeah. How are you guys making it easy? Cause it is really hard.
Oh,
like,
it's so hard.
I've literally like, I volunteered for like, okay, I'm not going to say like I'm some like, but but like, but it's, I've just like, I've like consistently like entered a little bit of like volunteer work and there's always barriers and there's different barriers depending on what type of work you're trying to do. But like, and every organization has all their like little issues or whatever,
right.
Like political campaigns, it's like spikes during really certain specific time periods and otherwise there's like nothing, you know, where people feel like there's nothing they can do. And like, you know, there's just like so many like weird nuances about it. So like, what do you guys do to make sure people have like stuff to be engaged with and different activities and stuff?
I think
like
you hit the nail on the heads of the biggest problems where it's just like a lot of the stuff that you can get involved with is like inconsistent and like I think that being generating passion for these issues would occurs over a long period of time, so you have to have like consistent ways to engage. And then also the issues are like complicated and opaque and hard to get into in a lot of the same ways that like we're talking like Medicare for All is like, you know, complicated and like we need to like crystallize it.
I mean, you're talking about a tech person, like they're like, where's the app? Like, I want to press a button. I need my like little, you know, you want your like, oh, what's my user journey for this like fixing homelessness?
We
like
have that's literally not drawn the funnel.
What's the funnel? Like, where? Exactly. Like, and you're like, there is no funnel. Like, it's like this complicated maze, and you're like, you know,
it's such a maze, and it's so complicated. I think the kind of my vision for simplifying this is, first, just like having a social media presence, like posting articles. I think the kind of like first step is just someone sitting on their screen and reading something about like, oh, like that tax didn't pass that would have like helped the homeless. Like, what happened there? Like, why did that happen? Just kind of like planting the seed. I think the next step is volunteering. I think getting in front of these issues in like a real kind of human to human way is important for people to realize what's going on. And it's also like pretty hard. And there are not a lot of like good kind of like structured volunteer events that are super easy to plug into. So one thing I've been working on the past couple of months is setting up sort of monthly volunteering events that, you know, it's going to be on the last like Wednesday or Thursday of the month. We're going to cook dinner for Plymouth Housing, which is a supportive housing provider in the city. And we're going to do that every month. And so if you're new to these issues and like don't like know a lot about policy or politics, because all that stuff is super complicated, just like cooking dinner, like chopping up some tomatoes to make a bigger day guy or something like that, and sort of getting face to face with people who are, I think, like 97% of people in Plymouth Housing are formerly homeless. Mm-hmm. And sort of like meeting those people and understanding what their life looks like and just sharing a meal with them is like a really powerful, like human-to-human experience, helpful, and I think kind of gets people thinking more about what they could do next. And then from there, the kind of next logical step is kind of the policy advocacy. And that, I think the real barriers are around just complexity. I think there are two large problems here in Washington. One is that we have very restrictive land use laws that essentially ban housing construction on 81% of the city's residential land, according to a New York Times article, via what's called single-family zoning. So for the past, like, three decades, like, wealthy homeowners have essentially...
Can you insert?
Yeah.
Crowd booing.
It is definitely worth booing. It's for like three decades, housing construction has been banned in 81% of the city and basically has created like what's effectively a housing shortage where like Amazon shows up and like people move to the city, but like we don't have a lot of room to build housing. And a lot of these like super wealthy neighborhoods that have access to the best parks and schools and transit essentially exclude anyone else from moving to their neighborhood because they ban housing construction.
This is a really interesting nuance because people move here and they're like, I don't get it. There's like apartments, or they see like condos downtown or something, or they see, you know, they might not think like, oh, there's like tons of houses, because that's not necessarily what people think of when they think of like affordable housing.
Right.
But they're like, oh, there must be like downtown, like places for people to live or whatever. And they don't realize what's actually happening with like the land usage across the whole city.
Totally.
And how that impacts the way people can live.
And I think that's intentional, that like in a lot of ways, single family zoning and like policies around home ownership are like meant to be like isolating and like it's for people like homeowners. Like I almost think of them sometimes as like people who like bought their home and essentially like think themselves as made it. And like any other change around them is like just going to bring them down from their peak. So a neighborhood like Laurelhurst, I was driving around with my partner the other day and just like being on Zillow, like, that's a $10 million home. That's an $8 million home. It's like a $6 million home. Like insanely, insanely wealthy neighborhood. You know, bans housing construction, might even ban like public transit from showing up to their neighborhood because they don't want to kind of see any change.
Don't want bike lanes, don't want anything like that would like disturb their tranquil.
So like very ultra NIMBY style, right?
Yeah, a lot of the neighborhoods are,
A lot of Alex Peterson signs in Laurelhurst. But I think it comes back to the psychology of the issue where it's like people don't spend time in Laurelhurst because only rich people live there. And like rich people essentially have constructed a system so that people don't spend time in their neighborhood, where it's like essentially they've systematically walled off. And so when we think about what we could do.
But it's not even just these rich enclave neighborhoods. It's like Wallingford, which is like a pathway that like is fairly busy and has lots of like business and, stuff like that. But then there's like a NIMBY like environment that is applied to that neighborhood. So like upzoning and like things changes to it are still, it's like there's this weird like cherished, you know, it's like an emotional thing that they think of the neighborhood versus like an actual real life situation, which is like we live in a city and people are busy and there's like you could probably have a little village and like da 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 da, but none of that is like it's not there.
I think you so hit the weird. Head nail on the head when you said it's emotional, like people love these neighborhoods, it's their home, they you know they have like hundreds of thousands of dollars invested in this thing, and you know when they see all that development going around them, that's this is for me like the origins of the greedy developer kind of narrative where it's like these are the developers are the you know rich fat cats that are somewhere else that are going to here to like change my neighborhood and like
and the city is in cahoots with them and they're just like profiting off of it
and it's all this super emotional like you know like not really fact-based stuff where it's like oh the developer is going to make it more expensive and it, and there is a kernel of truth to that like construction costs in the U.S. have gone up for a long time and that like if you were going to replace a single family home with like a triplex or something like that I think each triplex is like 10% more expensive or something like that than the single family home it replaced so there like there is some truth to the narrative that new housing is expensive and like new cars are expensive too.
Isn't there also there's a tie between single family house single family zoning and redlining as well is that like related or are they two separate kind of topics?
I think they're super related and if I were gonna summarize my understanding of the narrative essentially that like federal housing lending policies in the post-World War II era essentially did not guarantee loans to people who weren't white. And so people who are white kind of just march wherever they want, bought homes, like achieved the American dream. And this is all effectively subsidized by the federal government. And right. people who are black and brown ended up going to the kind of less desirable neighborhoods. The Central District is one common example.
Right.
And they weren't given loans and they were kind of like much more likely to be renters and not be able to build wealth in these. And essentially, while those policies aren't in place anymore, like single family zoning is like the snow globe that you put around that system. Where it's like, even right. though we don't have racist lending practices like we did in the 1960s,
mm-hmm.
like zoning is what perpetuates those practices so that right. all of the benefit that the federal government gave to the Laurelhursts and the Wallingfords of the world mm-hmm. is locked in.
Yeah.
And, right.
And by not changing the zoning laws, we are essentially like not giving any ways to like undo that kind of structural racism
mm-hmm.
that sort of was actively, sort of very actively practiced in the 60s, mm-hmm. but sort of carries forward and sort of has cascading effects, you know, each and every day where sort of wealthy white homeowners have built wealth via their homes right. in a lot of places and black and brown people who were denied loans and sort of failed to build equity. And now I think the wealth gap between sort of whites and non-whites is I forget the exact numbers, but they're huge. And that, yeah. that all yeah. comes back to housing policy for me. So there's zoning that sort of has this whole kind of like bucket of implications and large kind of ripple effects on what we do. But there's also a super regressive tax system in Washington state. Mm-hmm. I think Washington has the most regressive tax system in the United States, which means that rich people pay a smaller percentage of their income compared to poor people in Washington compared to anywhere else. And really, for me, if we're talking about sort of making housing more affordable and sort of giving public services so that people are helped out of homelessness, you know, all of these government programs cost money and the money has to come from somewhere. Right. And in Washington, it is just super hard to find funding. There was that sort of the head tax kind of debate that occurred in 2017. And super proud of Tech for Housing for supporting the head tax and sort of wanting to bring more revenue for the homelessness problem. But we struggle to raise revenue and kind of fund the social services that would make us kind of a more just, equitable society and like help people who are in need and undo the legacy of redlining by building a lot of affordable housing in mm-hmm. in wealthy neighborhoods mm-hmm. like Laurelhurst yeah. and Wallingford yeah. and things like that. And so if we want to make social progress on a lot of these important issues, it takes money, but that money is really hard to find because the tax system is so regressive that A, it's just like a financial burden on poor people, and B, if you right. want to fund these programs, you're kind of like put in this ugly position where it's like, okay, like, do I solve this problem? Do I like raise more money for affordable housing?
Yeah.
If that also means that I'm going to make poor people pay more sales tax at the cash register.
Right.
It just puts this kind of like
right.
the whole state in a bind. And so tax reform is the other kind of big part of this.
Yeah.
That I think would really move the needle.
And I think it's something that people don't connect necessarily. Like they're like, oh, you know, they think immediately like social services and the things that you have to do for people, but they and like government agencies and all that stuff. But they don't necessarily think about, oh, wait, we're overburdening our population, like the vast majority of our population anyways. So there's a reason why in the suburbs and like especially outside of the city, people feel like, oh, well, I'm already paying so much in taxes. Why should I have to like spend more? And they might do it for a school and they might do a levy for a fire department.
Yeah.
But if you said to them, oh, you know, you're going to pay more in taxes because we need to pay for, you know, public transit or whatever, they'd be like, fuck that. Like, I already pay like all of this. Or if you brought up, we don't pay income tax here at all, or like property tax, like they feel overtaxed and overburdened already because
right.
they're mm-hmm. the base is like already overburdened, right?
I also think people like fundamentally don't understand the system of taxation, and that's part of why they're like very resistant to paying taxes. You know what I mean? Like, even though it is pretty simple, it's also very complex. You know, like the idea is you pay taxes and those taxes go towards services that you enjoy or whatever,
right?
You know, but the actual specific maze of it all is like too overwhelming.
That same suburbanite will go to the city and they're like, oh, I see needles. Oh, I see. Yeah. They're complaining about some of the
that was
obvious cost yeah. to yeah. society, right. right? And to well-being. And they do it in a way that's anti-human. They're doing it in a way that's
also
like,
selfish.
That's
like it's like
shaming and shunning people, but they yeah. don't realize that oh, like this is a collective need of society, right, and that we should be like doing more.
Right.
Well, because it's like it's an inconvenience or like a disturbance to their day that there are tons of homeless people on the street that they have to like, you know, walk around and be like disturbed by. You know what I mean?
Like, yeah. No, I think that like you hit the nail on the head that like people who view homelessness as a like problem for them because they have to see it, like also have a lot of like ideas that like, you know, like the government isn't doing a good job with their tax dollars, and they kind of like just like
because
don't
they don't
make
understand
the
way that taxes are funneled to different programs.
Right.
That's what I'm saying. That's kind of what
I mean.
Well,
the hilarious part is that people in King County. So, like, I technically live in King County, so I pay a pretty high property tax. But so there's like this weird connection where people really want like super high property values because they're profiting off of it.
Right.
And they want that privilege and but then they're like, oh, but I don't want to pay like a really high property tax.
Right.
And it's like, what the fuck are you talking
about? I think there's like a deep like human psychology thing here where it's like people take the things that they benefit from like for granted really quickly. But the things that like bother them, they like assume are like constant, like, you know, constantly wrong. So like the roads that people drive on, the bus, the fact that there's a bridge that crosses the lake is just like, you know, a fact of life, you know, like totally unrelated to the fact that the government built it via taxes.
Yeah.
And then like the property tax bill that comes in every month is like, oh my God, like what are they doing with this money? Like there's so many needles. Yeah. Homeless.
But let's go back to the like, so for the head tax thing. So everyone like, so, I don't know, there's this thing like a trope of like everyone thinks they're going to be a millionaire or whatever. The head tax was supposed to be a tax on more on like bigger corporations, bigger businesses over a certain size. Go into that and maybe talk about like, why do you think that was so hard for people to kind of like get on board with? Because for me, I'm like, well, there's like really wealthy people and really wealthy corporations in Seattle. It's not like Seattle should be hurting for fun.
Yeah.
Right? Like there's like, it's like a hugely successful city with like millionaires, billionaires, like what's happening? I don't, you know?
Yeah. I mean, I think that's like the principle I start from, that like the wealthiest city in the world does have the capabilities to take care of its most vulnerable. Like that's just like has to be a given.
Baseline.
And that, like this has to be possible. But what happened in the head tax is that essentially the proposal was that there would be a $250, I think was the final legislation, per employee tax on companies that grossed more than $20 million in revenue in per year. So that includes Amazon, that includes, you know, Starbucks, Nordstrom. That also included what ended up including the grocery kind of lobby. So like they got involved, and that was kind of a more sympathetic type corporation, you know, if you're into that. But essentially the kind of
Dick's Burgers.
Oh, man. Don't
got
get
involved.
Oh, yikes. But I feel like the narrative that comes out sort of against these proposals is that I'm paying so much taxes to the city and homelessness is getting worse. Clearly the city is not doing what it can be done with the taxes, and that why should we give them any more money? The city council is dumb and evil, and no way I'm going to give them more money.
Yeah.
And so it ends up being this like weird kind of like, I would say conservative Seattleites are like pro business, but also like pro restrictive zoning. And so like the net of the philosophy is that, you know, they're anti-taxes, but also anti-zoning, and like want Amazon to keep growing because they're almost like proud of it because they own property in the city and like it growing, but don't like their world changing.
Yeah.
And so it's this narrative of fear, uncertainty, and doubt about homelessness spending that I think dominates. Mm-hmm. And basically what ended up happening, the head tax story ends by the Chamber of Commerce, which represents essentially the large business interests in the city, threatened the city council and basically said, hey, we're going to put the head tax on the ballot in November. And here's some polling data that says you're going to lose. Like, we have a lot of money at our disposal to go door to door and convince, you know, the median like 60-year-old homeowner voter in Seattle that the head tax is a bad idea. You're going to pass it and then you're going to sort of lose at the ballot box, and that's going to look really bad for you. And so the head tax ends up getting repealed. 7-2. It was council
members. Jerkin starts texting a bunch of people.
Yep.
Let some texts go around. Some texts start firing out, obviously. and then they repealed it.
Yeah.
Right.
And for me, the kind of the core methodology of those who oppose taxation is to just spread fear, uncertainty, and doubt about where those taxes are going.
Yeah.
And I do feel like our strategy is like leaves us a little bit open to that, where we do spend like, I think it's 70% of our homelessness budget on services. And when you have services, they're critically important, and you know, I'm sure they save lives and they do so much human good. But it's easy for people to kind of say bad things about them because, you know, the average homeowner hasn't seen the shelter that Mary's Place runs in Belltown to kind of understand where those money is going.
Yeah.
But I think if we I kind of want to.
Well, and there's this weird like, well, I'm a good person. I'm just going to give my money to someone. Why do I have to give it through the government? Like,
oh,
there's that weird
yeah.
like thing of like, well, Yeah. I, like, what are you assuming? I'm not a good person. Are you assuming that I can't, I'm not going to give? Like,
right.
That and is a thing. That is a Seattle thing.
I think sure. that is. So have you listened to Anand Giridharadas or read his book at all?
Uh-uh.
He essentially wrote this book called Winners Take All that pushes, essentially the thesis is that the elites in American society have essentially concocted a model where they will give a little bit in philanthropy and like, you know, like museums and stuff like that. And then they will kind of like with one hand and then with the other hand, they will just like viciously rig the system to be in their favor.
Yeah.
So he cites like the Sacklers, which is the family that owns Purdue Pharmaceuticals, which produces OxyContin. Mm-hmm. They like give like tens of millions of dollars to museums and the art world. Right. And in that sense, they're so good. But then on the other hand, they like make $30 billion selling OxyContin and kill like tens of millions of Americans.
I saw it get brought up because of Epstein and Gates. Came out today this week or whatever.
I think that's also just sort of a psychological absolving of your sins sort of thing, right? Like it's like something that you can hang your hat on as like, okay, well, I've done my deed for the day or the year or whatever, and then I can do all this insidious shit over here.
Or you're Bezos and you literally don't even have to have that moment.
Yeah. Like you're doing which we have discussed.
Yeah. I think people are super good at like retrospective justification and self-justification. And to like bring it back to homeowners, I think the kind of logic is like, I, you know, own my house. I earned my house. You know, this thing is mine.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I pay my taxes every year and they keep going up and the problem is getting worse. Like I am absolved of any obligation.
By
the
way,
situation.
These are people that think that they're progressive. Yeah. Liberal that are like good. Yeah. They're like, I'm a good person.
Right.
Yeah. And meanwhile, they do not realize that systemically they were at an advantage in society and that's how they came to their wealth.
Totally.
And it's not just like random or their own work.
Yeah.
It's like it's not just the system like, that gave them that privilege and power and money.
That's
like,
why they don't want to acknowledge that that system exists because then that takes away their work in, you know, and their sort of hero story.
Yeah.
No, it really does. That's the issue. That's like, basically we're talking about white privilege, right? I mean, like a huge piece of this. It's like that's why it's so hard for people to admit that white privilege exists, because that would be admitting that they're not some sort of superhero that overcame all these obstacles in their life and no one helped me along the way. Like I grew up poor. I, you know, whatever.
Well, the thing that is like boggles my mind about housing is that it seems so cyclical. Mm-hmm. There are these like moments in American history where it has bubbled to the surface and the same shit happens over and over and over and it's in different cities at different times. Yeah. And you see the same exact things happening where, you know, there was that HBO miniseries. Did you watch that?
Show Me a Hero?
Yes.
Oh, my favorite show
that
ever.
Was so good.
So freaking good.
But literally, like, there's a scene where there's a city hall or whatever, city meeting, council meeting or whatever, and there's people saying, we can't have these people live near us, or they can't, they'll bring crime, or, you know, and it's obviously racist. Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
Totally.
And then people literally in 2019 say the same exact things, and they think that they're not being racist or, you know, classist or whatever.
And I can't be a racist. I voted for Obama.
Right.
It's like an ownership of like, not only does it like, is it your house, but like the things around you, I think is like one of the most pernicious.
It's my neighborhood too.
Yes.
Yeah.
Right. And it's like, you know, we can't have lower income people like move to my neighborhood. They won't fit in as, you know, not with the neighborhood character.
But what they really are scared about is crime, and that what they maybe don't say or want to say, because that implies that they assume that people that are lower class are of a lower
crime ridden. Yeah.
And like oh God, it's like all steeped in such disturbing tropes about all of this stuff.
When really the American dream is supposedly home ownership and gaining wealth through working and these basic fundamental human rights that give you dignity and, you know,
well,
that
I think the American
dream
is like bullshit already. Like,
it's looking more and more bullshit with each day.
Right? Like the American dream is just like more white people bullshit.
Telling
themselves that they've done something special by just like having an advantage all along.
Right. And I think home ownership and like the relationship between home ownership and the American dream is like really problematic, where like home ownership is like,
it's
like
so
founded
specific
on exclusion and like wealth building via this mechanism that's also like a human right, and yeah. and you know, this like yeah. the financialization of housing, I think, is kind of one of the, like, the deeper trends going on here, where
right you're like, supposed to make a ton of money, it's supposed to be your investment, it's supposed yeah, to it's be
an,
your
wait is like is this is a house an investment or is a house a
where
human
you
right?
live
like, can, yeah. they, can they can it be both? I would argue it can't be both. Like, housing is a huh. place for people to live,
yeah,
and right. we like need a lot of it. The government needs to provide a lot of it as well. And when we view it as this thing that's supposed, like, whose value is supposed to, you know, go up faster than the economy, yeah. like, it can't,
right.
it ceases
Doesn't
to perform
Doesn't it remind
both
you of
functions.
The minimum wage argument? It's like, well, they don't deserve to make that amount of money. They work at McDonald's. And it's like, oh, they God. Don't deserve a house. They're, you know, poor. And it's well, the same shit. It's like, well, and why doesn't someone deserve to live?
The,
like,
the whole argument, or if you can call it that, that, like, poor people should just try harder, or, like, you know, it's somehow like their fault that right. they're not right. lifting yeah. themselves right. out of poverty.
Yeah. Why don't they have, like, systematic advantages each right. and every day of right. their life right. that makes yeah. them, like, get exactly. this nice paying white collar job that I work so quote unquote hard for?
And they're already fucking homeless. Like, yeah. that's literally the bottom of yeah. right. like
the
where you can be.
Of unhoused people is, like, I think one of the most disturbing aspects of it to me, just
it's
because
really scary.
It's like, I hear people constantly say things like,
oh, disturbing,
really
shit.
Derogatory
yeah.
about
yeah.
people that are, like, just trying to live their
yeah.
lives.
Oh,
and
my
it's
God.
Like,
just trying to survive, could actually.
You, could you even imagine trying to, like, you can, there is nowhere to go to the bathroom downtown.
Right.
Like, oh, literally, there's right. nowhere to, like, do anything.
It has to be one of the most difficult and grinding yeah. sort of lives to live. And, like, that, you know, wealthy people in their homes kind of, like, look at these other people who don't have homes, and it's like, oh, that's like a yeah. that's like a personal failure on there. It's like, no,
yeah.
it's like, this
they
is...
have to be a drug addict, they have to be an alcoholic,
right.
yeah. they
right.
have to have something wrong with them. No one listens to any data. Also, like, for someone who's, like, supposed to be, like, it's like, oh, you work in tech, like, we're data driven. Like, you're actually supposed to look at a study that says that homelessness is not caused by drug addiction
right.
and alcoholism, that it's actually based on the systemic issue of being unhoused and being unstable,
right,
that, like, it gets worse because you're
yeah.
unhoused and unstable, and
right.
that you can fix it if you're,
yeah.
and that drives me nuts.
It's,
that
it's
no
like a crazy narrative
that.
like, oh, homelessness yeah. has gone up since, like, 2010. It's like, oh, wait, have like people just become less disciplined since 2010, or did, like, Amazon show up and the rents have gone up by, like, 60% or whatever?
Right.
Like, it's, like, obviously a housing affordability issue if you look at through that lens, but
right.
people are, like, just get really emotional about it. And I think what drives a lot of the kind of, like, distrust towards city council is that, like, people feel emotional about the homelessness problem and view it as, like, a personal failure. And I actually do think the city council does a great job, like, looking at data and trying to, like, create the best policies for those people. And, like, some of those policies, just, like, investing a bunch of money in permanent supportive housing, don't align with people's, like, emotional reaction to the views. And so then you kind of, like, just have this endless cycle of, like, oh, the council's doing a bad job, you know, like,
right.
vote them all out. But it's... You know, it's going to be an endless cycle unless we can kind of, like,
yeah.
build a coalition and a stronger narrative around that, where
yeah.
it's like, no, we have a moral obligation to help these people. We help these people by giving them housing because housing
yeah.
is a human right. It costs money to give that housing,
yeah.
and wealthy tech workers like me, like, should pay higher taxes in order to get that housing.
Yeah.
And it's a complicated narrative.
It'll take time to build that, like, narrative of, I did see a billboard just the other day of, like, Plymouth Housing, and it was like, we gave this person a chance, and, like, and it's, like, a very nice picture. You have to use, like, kind of rosy imagery,
yeah,
and, like,
yeah.
use the best examples
right.
of mm-hmm. like
yeah
what how this has worked out or whatever,
mm-hmm.
and that kind of, like, helps get people into the oh, okay, like,
right,
yeah, like,
next layer down.
Okay, someone can live in a tiny home in a backyard, and it's, like, very managed, and there's these social workers, and then they can kind of, like, start to picture it
yeah.
being successful, which
yeah.
is good.
Right.
I'm just trying to understand. So we keep talking about the emotional response sort of issue that is at the root of this, where people are, like, very emotional about the effect on themselves and their home and their neighborhood, and, like, that ownership, that it's all tied up in this emotional, like, gripping of things around you, you know, that, like, no one else can have these or whatever. But how do we translate that personal emotional response to then being like, oh, I'm a part of this city, like, it's not just me and my home and my neighborhood, like, all of those things exist in this city, in this state, where, like, I have a personal responsibility for like the greater good to help these people.
That sounds quite un-American to me.
It's like really socialist, actually.
Oh, sounds kind of European.
Wait, we're not socialists, right?
God, it's just like I don't understand the like where we're missing,
like
thinking
that of like a collective society and like how you
but also wanting everything to be better but having no sort of personal stake in being part of making things better, you know, like being like, well, I don't want my property taxes are already so high, I can't pay anymore, like, you know what I mean? Like, it's like, but how else are we supposed to do that? Like, who's going to do it?
Right.
Yeah. If not all of us agreeing that this is important.
Well, first we need to get rid of Sinclair Media and Como News.
Oh, man.
And Jason Rance. And
okay, let's talk about that because that's on your list.
Media is, I think local media plays a huge part in these horrible... And national media, even Fox, Donald Trump.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's going all the way up now.
Had an opinion on housing.
Can we include Safe Seattle as media or does that not count as media?
I mean, Safe Seattle is a hate group, first of all.
Yep, that's correct.
We have to say it on this podcast now because we haven't said it yet before. But
I hope they give you a shout out now.
In this episode, we have to say it. Ooh, it would be my dream.
I feel like technology and media is actually related here where, like, before tech... There was just like 5 cable TV news stations and they were all like relatively middle of the road and like they kind of told some version of the truth-ish maybe and it was all fine. And like tech has just allowed this explosion of like different tinier media outlets that go way far to the left and way far to the right.
Yeah.
And created spaces for people like, you know, or for like Safe Seattle that gives people who like maybe didn't have views that were like largely acceptable to society. It gave them a space. And so... Now you have like Safe Seattle for people who are like way on the right. And then like a little less to the right, you have like Como News and Seattle is dying. Mm-hmm. And so there's just been this proliferation where anyone who has like, you know, some emotional feeling about homelessness can go to a media outlet and get that validated.
Yeah. And that's like a larger issue where you can like confirmation bias or whatever. You can confirm whatever your fear is very quickly easily by just Googling it and finding the people that tell you, yes, you are, all of your fears are valid and you are right and everyone around you is out to get you.
And then you can find a community of those similar people and then all just like drive each other crazy and like send
piranhas
each other off
in a lake, you know, just like feeding off of them.
Yeah.
Little guppy or whatever they eat. I don't know, but.
Yeah, I mean, it does make it seem much more important to like outweigh that narrative with like other narratives and to try to kind of combat the constant flow because it is a constant flow and it's like generated from pretty large scale operations. Like
totally.
It's not like a it's not just like Safe Seattle. It's like, no, Safe Seattle has connected to this other like org across the country and like or something in DC or like you know what I mean, like they're
and now all the way up
network.
To like Fox News
all the way
and
to Fox
like
News.
Trump's Twitter feed
totally
like, it's a giant machine. Like I think the advantage that we have on the progressive, empathetic, whatever side you want to call us on is that like our side
socialist
is,
actually
the socialist side is that like we have the truth and we have like empathy and like those are like very powerful principles that like, you know, like Safe Seattle and essentially like fake news media outlets.
Yeah,
they don't. Where it's like, if you do a volunteering event with Plymouth Housing and you show up to permanent supportive housing, and then you cook dinner, and then you meet those people, like yes, we believe a lot of what we see in the media, but it is, I think, more powerful and more appealing on a deeper level to kind of like be face to face with the truth and the reality, and like I feel like that's the kind of those are the kinds of forces that are going to like. Elevate this cause and sort of like quote unquote win in the end where it's like we have empathy, we have sort of like reality and like we can bring people along.
You're not buying
you look
it.
Very
okay, I'm like I'm trying really hard in this climate to not be defeatist all the time, but I worry that yes, we have the truth and we have empathy and all of these powerful sort of like inspirational like MLK type things, right? But they have propaganda machines that is like a giant megaphone. Like the description of how it goes from like these creepy little seeds and goes all the way up to the top to like Trump's Twitter. Like
yep.
It's a giant megaphone to spew the opposite of the truth and the opposite of like
yeah
lies and fear and all of that stuff. And you're just, what you're describing sounds really great to me. Like, I want to go
but
volunteer.
But you're biased towards.
Exactly. Yeah. I'm already on board with the concept of helping people survive. So, like, how do we get people there? That's what concerns me.
I think I would draw a distinction between the strength of the media and the societal conversation at the national level versus the local level.
Sure.
Like, I think when it comes to national news and, like, what's happening at the border, like, virtually all of our knowledge comes from our media sources. And so, like, the New York Times versus Fox News is, like, the only players in the game, and that's all they can do. But one of the reasons I find local issues just, like, more satisfying to work on is that I do think it has these nice, like, aspects to it where it's, like, you know, it's right in front of you. It's reality. Like, you know, Putin can't, you know, run a fake news campaign about, you know, whether or not there's, you know, housing and, you know, this, you know, cross street. Like, it's easier to have a lower, a more realistic, kind of a less emotional conversation at the local level just because it's right in front of you. And honestly, I think that I talked to Heidi Groover, who's a transportation reporter at the Seattle Times. And one thing that, if you don't know, like, the Seattle Times editorial board is, like, a very large mouthpiece for a lot of, like, NIMBY kind of anti-tax kind of conservative viewpoints. And it's very, very frustrating because, you know, they have such a high readership and it's arguably really damaging to
our
cause. I
can feel the frustration from the reporters, some of them.
Exactly. But, and so I chatted with Heidi and I was like, can we do anything? And, like, Heidi, I think, would, you know, agree with us socialists about these issues. And she essentially was like, yeah, you know, I agree the Seattle Times editorial board is frustrating, but, like, a lot of the candidates and causes they've endorsed in the past, you know, whatever years have lost. Like, you know, they don't represent a lot of the kind of views that the average voter ends up, like, going out and voting for. And so, like, I think we kind of have these, like, magic moments at the ballot box, like, every couple, every 2 years or whatever, where, you know, essentially the views of the city come down. And we had one of those in August. We had, like, Ari Hoffman, who's the kind of, like, biggest, like, anti-homeless candidate in District 2. He had, like, a dismal showing. He was, like,
notoriously cool guy. So cool.
But, like, I do think that at the ballot box, like, a progressive candidate, or maybe socialist candidates, do a lot better than, like, the Seattle Times editorial board would have you make you feel.
Yeah.
And I think that's a lot of, like, the narrative around, like, how shitty a job the city council is doing. Like, I personally think they're doing a great job. Like, it's just, like, the media kind of, like, being more conservative than the average Seattle voter. And so, like, we get council members like Teresa Mosqueda and Lorna Gonzalez that are just, like, amazing on these issues, like, super just, like, smart, like, race and social justice forward, like, get stuff done type mentalities. And we don't hear a lot about that in the media because a lot of the large media outlets kind of, like, don't support those narratives. Yeah. But, like,
it's like a surface level conversation. And then there's, like, the weeds where all this stuff is happening.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
they probably aren't really paying that much attention or close of attention to some of that. And you can kind of get
You're
stuff
like,
done.
Okay, good. They're distracted. Now I can actually get the work done.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Like, okay, let's, like, work together on this. Like, let's
just quietly over here.
And sometimes they, like, go so crazy that it's like obviously just, like, kind of exclusive and, like, semi-hateful stuff that comes out of the editorial board where it's like, they like said, like, they're trying to fearmonger about accessory dwelling units and saying, like, oh, we're gonna have, like, you know, a triplex and there could be, like, 24 renters in your neighborhood. This is, like, a horrible paragraph to write in the sort of paper of record in the city. And it was just like, I think a lot of people just looked at that and was like, wow, the Seattle Times editorial board is, like, kind of, like,
everybody knows that the Seattle Times is, like, problematic and conservative.
Yeah.
I don't know. I just think, like, there is a weird thing happening with Seattle where we do have a huge influx of people moving here and not necessarily from a city, right?
Thanks, like, Calvin.
Oh, I'm sorry, everybody.
Well, because what you're saying is, like, Amazon provided all this growth. There's all this tech boom. Great. Amazing. I love that Seattle is an actual city and people want to move here and all this stuff. But at the same time, there's people coming to the city that, like, don't really necessarily understand what's happening in the city. They don't understand the homelessness. They don't understand the housing crisis. Yeah. Fundamentally, they don't understand what's behind it. They just see what's in front of their face and they're very prone and easy to jump on those narratives. And so that's really disappointing to me. I'm like, well, I just wish there was, like, another narrative that can combat that people could, like, easily latch onto, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think that, you know, one of the core challenges throughout building these narratives is that the emotional narrative is, like, fast and easy.
Right.
And, like, the kind of narrative that we're trying to build is like longer term and like, you know, is slower. And, like, we just,
it's like,
okay,
more after you cool off, I'll come back.
Right.
And then we'll talk about it again.
We'll talk through this.
But I also fundamentally don't understand someone who's like, oh, sweep. Cool. Like, I've literally encountered people that are like, get them off the, like, they're like, don't care where people go.
It's like, where do you think, like, what do you think happens to those human beings that just get swept? Like, yes, they're not physically in front of you, but like, what's like the next thing
they
your
just
head?
Don't,
like, what happened to
they
them?
They just don't care.
It's,
and I'm like, what do you think happened? And also, here's the other fucked up thing, that, like, you know, the rosy picture thing I was saying, like, there are like families, like there are people that, like, there are kids that are unhoused in the city. And something that people don't talk about is like, so, you know, the overall number of unhoused dropped slightly in the last year or whatever, but also the number of people living in cars is huge and growing. Huge.
But the number of deaths also grew.
Yeah, the number of deaths grew, and the number of people that have, basically people are transitioning from house to car, right? Yeah. There's like all these people living out of cars. Often that can be a family. And so, and I think that the picture people have in their head is like very specific, and we all know what that is.
Yep. Yep.
And they're not picturing all of these different scenarios and what could happen to people where they're just literally like, you know, they're one paycheck away from being unhoused.
Yeah.
Which is so like, real. That
and
is
then you lose your
real.
Job and then you know you...
Or you could still be working, but you just can't get to it because it's in the city. And blah, 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 like, you know.
Yeah, and like domestic violence is a big cause of homelessness, where it's like, you know, people who don't have, you know, anywhere else to go, but like have to leave their house. It's like, the shelter. And and like, I think you're totally right that, like, I think the stat is around like only 25% of homeless or people experiencing homelessness are like on the street unsheltered. And then the like 75% is like, you know, they're on their friend's couch or they're like in a shelter, but they don't have permanent housing or they're in their cars. Like this whole like
there's
the
always that
stat
about people
only,
in college that are like technically homeless, but they don't really get count. You know what I mean? Yeah, like they kind of like slip through
like
the cracks or whatever.
People, what do you mean?
There's like people that like go to school at like couch surf or whatever, and they're like can't afford to live. They can't afford food, and they're like technically in that category, but they just don't. They kind of
interesting. Yeah, I mean, I hadn't even like considered someone who's just like staying with friends, perpetually bopping around or whatever, and like not actually living anywhere.
When we could be like, I mean, there could be more affordable units like in the city.
Right. Yeah, like if the city was more affordable and had abundant affordable housing, like they would just live in housing and they would have an address that they could get mail and their like all their like UW like bailing stuff would like like the kind of layers of this problem are like super deep and like the human impact is so huge.
There's also really huge population of LGBTQ people that are unhoused.
I think as especially like as the LGBTQ people get older, like kind of like there's a lot of risk of like having going to homelessness, and so I've seen some projects go up that are like specifically targeted towards LGBTQ elders, and like those kinds of things are awesome, and like we don't think about these different kind of like, you know,
scenarios.
Parts of society that might be experiencing this problem, but it's super important. And by building affordable housing, we can do so much good for people.
Yeah.
And by sort of spreading fear, uncertainty, and doubt about sort of homelessness spending, I think it's an obstacle, but one that I think we can get over.
Can we talk really quickly about, so, you know, we were talking about the head tax. So right after the head tax, all that debacle, we should talk really quickly about the tech panel that Durkin started.
Yeah, because I
think this is like a really interesting thing that you should speak on, because I think that lost a lot of trust in like the tech community to for them to tackle. I mean, it wasn't really tech specific. I mean, it's like big business, whatever. A lot of the like bigger corporations that were involved. But basically, it's the Innovation Council that Durkin started to
innovate out of this problem.
That we're going to innovate. Yeah. So what were your feelings on that? And like,
we're like innovated into this problem.
Yeah.
Right.
That's a good way of putting it.
Basically.
Un-innovate.
Yeah,
I mean, the council's kind of a joke at this point, right? It's like, oh, what are you going to do? You're not giving us any like information on what your progress is. Like, what are you even like tasked with? It's just such this like what you're saying, like opaque, like, okay, come on. Like, and isn't it just a way for these businesses to kind of like push it down the road and just continue to like kick the can?
Yeah. Like, so I think that, you know, I'm not going to tell anyone to not innovate. Like, I'm not going to tell Zillow to, well, like, I'm not going to tell Zillow, like, I think they were working on, like, an app or a website that would, like, connect people, like, aggregate all the places where you can find affordable housing into, like, one affordable housing search portal. So, like, that's great. You know, like, if you ever go on one of these affordable housing search portals, they're, like, kind of weird. They're, like, old and, you know, ugly, and there's, like, five of them that you have to go to, and it's, like, really tedious. And so, if, like, you lower the barriers, you know, that's a good thing. I'm not going to tell Zillow to not make that website. But also, like, we have to keep in mind that, like, the we just have to get a sense of like how foundational is the solution that we're talking about. Like, mm-hmm. do we have a problem where the affordable housing search website is not good enough, or do we have a problem right. like we don't have enough affordable housing
yeah.
in our city?
Yeah, like is that the problem that you're solving?
Oh, but Calvin, exactly. it's such low hanging fruit.
Yeah, you're solving a problem, I guess.
Right.
Or really, it's just like one of those things where it's a Band-Aid and. You have a gushing
yeah, because someone that's worked in social services for like, you know, a decade or whatever would be like, well, there's only one unit or there's one bed yeah. or whatever. Yeah. Like, yeah.
Yeah.
I think that like the we get into a problem where it's like the mayor might use this as like, oh, we're doing something. Oh, victory. And like kind of use that to like as a rough counterweight to like a failure to actually fund more affordable housing. Where it's like, do it kind of like we were talking about earlier, where it's yeah. like you do a little bit of good and then yeah. that outweighs like the whole lot of bad you do
right,
on
right,
the other side.
Right.
And because yeah. people are kind of bad at like getting a sense of how big things are. So like we cannot have these kind of like innovative technology solutions be like, it's not like we ship them and we're done. It's like, okay, like that's just like a tiny grain of sand in like a giant mountain of a problem.
Yeah.
Like, sure, it's all hands on deck. We should do as much as possible. We have to keep in mind that the foundational issue yeah. here is housing affordability.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And then if we're not moving the needle and making more affordable housing, we are not solving the problem.
Yeah. I think a lot of that is basically like PR. Like
it's lawyers
yeah.
and PR.
It gives,
yeah.
it
the
gives
lawyers got involved and
people
like-
that are scared to actually get involved in this a reason to go like, oh good,
yeah.
I'm
yeah.
out now, like
right.
yeah. I was worried and now I'm not gonna worry about it because they're like doing totally something
right. Yeah, do I think that there are people that actually care and like are good people that work at Amazon and Zillow and
Microsoft.
I'm sure there are. We're talking to one of them, but like at a fundamental level, their corporations, their goals are for profit and
yeah.
for their stakeholders, and are they really going to be activists?
Yeah.
No. Well, like that's not part of their like business model, right?
Yeah.
Like,
yeah. I think that like I don't want to sound overly defensive, but like I would draw a distinction between like tech management and like
yeah.
Amazon the institution versus like Amazon the employees. Like
right.
a bunch of Amazon employees just did a climate walkout or are going to do a climate walkout next Friday,
uh-huh.
Which is awesome. And like I do think a lot
yeah.
of the ground level employees who just like work there and it's like just to have a job and like take a paycheck, like see these issues as important and like join Tech for Housing.
Yeah,
and,
yeah,
like
yeah.
maybe some other groups and get involved in their community in different ways. So like, I think the interests of Amazon, the institution, are at odds with us making progress on this very important social problem.
Yeah.
I think the sort of employees at these companies are much less wed to the kind of like well-being of Amazon. And
oh, yeah.
like, you know, if Amazon gets a head tax and like their paycheck goes down by $250 every year, it's like not a big deal. And I think a lot of the employees would like to see that kind of tax. Well, okay.
question
there
that.
there are employees because some of them okay. are part of Tech for Housing and some of them like show up and like testified at this hearing saying like, hey,
mm-hmm.
tax us more. So there is like the people and the corporation are different. And I like do believe in the capacity
there
of people
are,
to do good things.
There are a couple people at Amazon that have morals and
I mean, I
want to do good.
I do think
we know of. So out of your list of 800, how many?
I have my checklist in my backpack.
Yeah. I think that it is important to distinguish like Amazon, the entity, from the minions of Amazon. However, it must be sort of a moral quandary being a minion and caring about these
yeah.
issues,
yeah.
but also
yeah.
needing
no,
a paycheck.
Absolutely, like super interesting moral question.
Yeah.
Microsoft just announced a big investment in housing.
Yeah, so
they?
Microsoft like announced this like $500 million fund. It was like a revolving fund that they'll like loan money out to affordable housing developers. I think it's just like this weird, like affordable housing developers have this weird balance sheet problem where they kind of like need financial guarantees at some point. So I think that's what the money's doing. It's very opaque.
Weird, huh?
And like, I work at Microsoft. I feel like Microsoft gets like a little bit of a free pass on a lot of these issues just because mm-hmm. Microsoft builds software for enterprises. And if you like screw over like, you know, Equifax or something because you like shipped some crappy software, then like, you know, people aren't going to get up in arms. But if you're like Amazon and you like work employees to death,
yeah.
like, you know, it's a lot easier to sort of, you know, like Amazon has like a lot more like morally thorny issues. So I don't think like Microsoft is like a better, like more moral company. And like the data centers that Microsoft run like spin a lot of computers and there's a lot of electricity and not a lot of those data centers are using as much renewable energy as they should. So
yeah.
like I think as
they've
society,
had a little bit of a gender equity issue as well.
Oh, yeah.
yeah.
yeah. But they're just starting to get their way out of just recently. But yeah. I know what you're saying. Like, I mean, it's just because you make like an investment or you have like some fund or whatever, it doesn't mean that you're like off the hook.
Yeah.
But it is good to see a little bit of.
Here's the reality. We all have jobs in this room and yeah. therefore we're all contributing to capitalism, which is yep. the root issue here.
Right. Like, given a society structured in a way that we cannot opt out.
Yeah.
Like, what is what is our moral responsibility as we like interact with this society?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it's sort of interesting because all of us have to do both. Right. Yeah. It's like we're like doing double Dutch or whatever. We're like we're doing this and we're living and we're surviving and we're making money. And we're also like trying to help other people.
So what's your advice for someone working in tech that wants to do better, get involved, is like interested, even if they're just like slightly interested in this topic that they're like, oh, I think, you know, I want to learn more.
Yeah.
Like,
how do you hook them?
Yeah.
Oh, I think that the advice I'd give to people who want to get more into these issues is, you know, start reading up, like start thinking about different kind of groups that might appeal to you. You know, maybe Tech for Housing is a good group to be a part of. Like maybe there's a bunch of other, there's a million other kind of groups you can get involved with.
Mm-hmm.
But like, I think I would advise them to kind of keep in mind that like these issues are hard and like finding your space in this like kind of complicated landscape can take a long time and is intimidating and it might involve like going to a lot of like really crappy and boring meetings that are really awkward for you because you don't know anyone there and you don't know the speaker and the speaker's not even that good. And that changing the system, like if we are a part of the system that is immoral, then and we are trying to change the system, then changing the system is hard and takes time. But we like there, it is possible, and
it's kind of boring, and you just have to accept that.
Yeah, like it's not gonna. Yeah, I think it's another great point. It's like it's not gonna be flashy. It's not gonna be like laid out for you.
Yeah.
Tech has gotten us used to like, oh, everything's just like two clicks away, and everything's super easy.
God,
and, like,
yeah.
Systems change is not that, and it's complicated and thorny and involves working with a lot of other people and like thinking about a super diverse group of interests. And so we have to be a lot more careful and work a lot more collaboratively. But I think we should like I think we have a moral obligation to and that. To the extent that people can devote their resources and time and mental energy to solving some problem that you feel like is important, I think people ought to.
Yeah. And hey, you can morally absolve yourself from the other shitty things you do the rest of the week.
Yeah, you can spend, you know, 40 hours a week selling widgets or whatever and then like spend like 2 hours on, you know, helping people in need. Like, come on, people.
This is an app idea. There's like a moral accounting app where you like input what you did that week and then it's like gives you all the
It's a piggy bank. It's like a moral piggy bank. Yeah, this is good.
We do need to gamify it.
You gotta.
That's the real solution, actually.
What's our data? What's our key results?
How can we mobilize and engage and
get
these tech workers into the funnel?
So we usually rate our topics on a scale from 0 to 5 somethings.
0 to 5 rent checks?
0 to 5 slumlords.
Oh, oh boy. Are these supposed to be good things or bad things?
0 to 5 apodments.
Oh.
Ooh.
Is that good or bad?
Apodment.
Yeah. Tough moral quandary.
0 to 5 plexes? Like a
zero. Yeah, I liked the mother-in-law triplex duplex sort of vibe. I like 0 to 5 plexes.
It's like how big do we want our plex to be?
Yeah. How many plex does it take till you get to the center?
Oh, okay, so your rating is the plex.
Yeah. Yeah, that's how many plexes.
Yeah.
Okay.
That's an interesting question.
I like that. It's perplexing, you might say.
Wow.
We're going off the rails.
You should be on SNL.
Okay. 0 to 5 plexes.
Who wants to start? You start.
I'll start. I feel like I like plexes, but like I do want to acknowledge that change is scary. So like maybe 5 is too many. So like a 4 plex. I feel like that would undo a lot of our kind of issues.
So you're rating housing 4 plexes.
Four plexes.
I like a 4 plex. That's like potentially a lot of beds, a lot of people in beds.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, I did want to clarify like the lens of your 4-plex rating on housing as an issue. Is it like the work that's being done?
Like the state of the...
Yeah.
Oh, like what about the issue is 4-plexes?
Yeah.
I would say the kind of state of the housing advocacy community is 4-plexes. I've only been involved in these issues for like 2 years, but I feel like we're in a really awesome spot with a lot of collaboration, a lot of amazing players doing amazing work. like focusing a lot on race and social justice.
Yeah.
Kind of like building a broad coalition. We always could be broader. We could always lead more with race and social justice issues, but I feel like we're mobilizing. We're getting better. So I'll say the housing advocacy communities at four plexes.
Okay. Nice.
Allison.
Yeah, I think I like the idea of blending kind of like advocacy with the general state of like housing overall. I mean, obviously we're viewing this from a lens of our city and our communities and all that stuff, so it's very like specific. But I do think like nationally, you know, more people are moving to cities and this is just going to become more and more of an issue. I think the fact that you have Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump talking about housing right now is like just emblematic of how it's going to grow and grow and grow as an issue. Yeah. And that, you know, I think more and more people talking about how to house people and that shelter should be a right is so important that, you know, I really do want housing and housing as a human right to take the stage more in national news and not just by Fox News or in local like Sinclair stations or whatever. I just think that's like so important. And the work that advocates are doing is so important. And the reason it gets me so fired up is that there is so much misinformation and so many things that people say that are just so troubling. And like, I think that there's a lot of work to be done, but yeah, housing is a human right. And I give it a 5 plex.
Oh. Woo.
So,
okay. I want to be cautiously optimistic. So, I think I'm going to do a 3 plex. Wait, triplex?
Yeah.
Triplex. Mm-hmm. Because on one hand, like the work that you're doing and it sounds like many other people are doing, and also just thinking about it, like having it, like you're talking about, having it be sort of more of a concept that people even think about being an issue that we need to address is bodes well, hopefully. And then on the other hand, it's such a fucking huge issue. Like, and it feels insurmountable. It seems insurmountable, especially because there are so many establishments that are actively not fixing this issue. Ergo, my triplex rating. So hopefully the state of housing now is where I'm docking 2 plexes.
I get that.
Yeah.
But like I said, and I'm like, I'm feeling very inspired by the work that you're doing and just how knowledgeable and, you know, like you, I'm feeling like I want to go make dinners like you were talking about for Plymouth House and stuff like that. I want to like get involved more. And I think if we can get more people on board.
And you're right. There are really good things happening in places where... you know, maybe super majorities on the West Coast of Democrats and all that stuff, like very progressive. I mean, there are good changes that are happening.
Yeah.
And hopefully the Seattle process will just move out of the way and allow some of that stuff to continue to, I just think they could be so much more productive here if they just kind of like started to really get through these issues. And so, yeah, because there's like other things, too. It's not just housing. There's like other really important, you know.
Well, there's so many things tied into the idea of housing. Yep. And
yeah,
I mean, it's like, again, we just have to burn it all down.
And rebuild it with more plexes.
Yeah. Yeah.
More plexes.
Okay. Well, thank you so much.
Yeah.
For,
thank you so much
for having me.
Tell people how to find you, how to find Tech for Housing, all that stuff.
If you just Google Tech for Housing with the number 4, not F-O-R, join our Facebook group. That's probably where the most activity happens, and I post way too much. And there are other ways to get involved. Like Tech for Housing might not be the group for you, but there are lots of groups out there you can get involved with. You come to a meeting, like maybe point you another direction. No form of advocacy is too small. And the last thing I want to say is that general election ballots for the Seattle City Council are due November 5th. And voting is a super important form of advocacy. So everyone should vote.
Do you have any endorsements you want to announce?
A candidate will either be endorsed by the Seattle Times editorial board or The Stranger. And The Stranger is the right endorsements.
Like, right.
I can almost guarantee that is the dichotomy that is going to happen in the general election.
I mean,
the Seattle Times editorial board will endorse the conservative candidates, and The Stranger will endorse the progressive candidates.
I mean,
so just go with The Stranger.
Story of our lives, truly.
Yeah.
Really strong endorsements game for The Stranger. Gotta give it to him.
Yeah.
Among other things.
Okay, cool.
Awesome.
Thank you
so much.
Thanks so much for having me on. This was really fun.
If you have something to get off your chest, email us at rantandreviewpod@gmail.com or leave us a voicemail at 805-635-RANT. That's 805-635-7268.
If you like Rant and Review, and we know you do, please rate and review us on Apple Podcasts and subscribe on your favorite podcast app.
Bye.